we take you now to the First Unitarian Church in Santa Monica, July 29th, 1993. Jonathan Ott's presentation, Pharmacotheon, one of the great talks. KPFK Los Angeles.
Now I want to introduce Jonathan Ott, who is one of the most knowledgeable and exciting researchers in the field, the entire field of psychedelic entheogenic drugs. Jonathan has worked very closely over the years with Gordon Wasson, who you must know was the first white man to reveal the secrets of the mushroom to Western consciousness. He's frequently called the discoverer of the psilocybin mushroom, but that's really a rather ethnocentric position. He didn't discover it at all. Jonathan has also worked very closely with Albert Hoffman for many years. He translated Albert's spiritual autobiography, Scientific and Spiritual Autobiography. And he's also worked closely with Richard Schultes, who's discovered for the Western mind practically every psychedelic plant that Gordon and Albert missed. Jonathan's here because he has just finished writing and will soon be out. We have just a couple of copies of his magnum opus, Pharmacotheon, which I've just been able to flip through a little bit, and I've read practically everything in the field of psychedelic drugs and history, and this one is the most complete and exciting book to come out in a long time. So please, thanks all for coming, and join me with welcoming Jonathan Ott.
Thank you. Normally, I don't like to read lectures, but I'm going to do that tonight, and I want to beg your indulgence, and I'll explain a little bit why. As Bob mentioned, I just am now publishing this book, Pharmacotheon. Unfortunately, we don't have copies to sell, but it is in print, finally. And what I'm going to read to you tonight is sort of a condensation of the proemium or introduction to this book. And as I was writing the book, I could say I've been working on it full-time for about 2 years as a full-time endeavor, but working on gathering the information for about 20 years. And when I started writing it, I decided, well, I better keep politics out of this, because if I don't, it will be impossible to get it published. And but then I found it was coming out at the seams, and there were all these footnotes being appended to dry scientific discussions dealing with the political aspect, and there's really no way to divorce politics from the science in this field. It has become politicized because the field itself is illegal. It's this pall of disreputability has been cast over it by the legal misclassification of these substances. So I decided, well, I will just take the bull by the horns and I'll go directly for the jugular and deal with the political aspect of it right up front. And so that's what I've done. And I had to publish it myself. So anyway, and ordinarily I would rather speak extempore about this or about anything else, but I tend to, even if I'm given the subject of one plant, it usually takes me about 3 hours to get through the basics, and so, and this is a bigger subject, and so I decided the best thing to do would be to condense it, and then I can go hit the high points and really get to the meat of it in about an hour, and so that's what I've done. And I will read it, but there will be plenty of time for discussion, and I hope it will stimulate some lively discussion. And the title I've given this excerpt is Crimes Against Nature, the Civil War on Drugs. To paraphrase America's rustic president, Abraham Lincoln, we are now engaged in a great civil war, testing whether the modern nation state or its citizens will be the ultimate arbiter and judge of individual well-being and health, whether the citizen will be responsible for what pleasure drugs she or he chooses to ingest or to eschew, or whether an ostensibly benevolent, paternalistic state, supposedly guided by science and reason, will make that decision in loco parentis. Those paranoid individuals with no faith in the inherent wisdom and dignity of human beings today hold the upper hand, and ill-conceived laws have been crafted to proscribe certain drugs, with the unanticipated and unintended consequence of illegalizing innumerable plants and animals which we now know to contain those drugs. It is, of course, absurd for humankind to presume to illegalize other organisms with which we share this planet, and this could be seen as a laughable example of human folly run wild, were it not for the mounting toll of victims this tragic abuse of law and authority increasingly claims. Spinoza presciently foresaw the consequences of misguided attempts to, quote, control the desires and passions of men, unquote. And it is evident that the millions of contemporary users of proscribed drugs are laughing at the laws presuming to forbid them, and that they are far from deficient in the ingenuity needed to outwit those laws. It has ever been so with laws regulating the legitimate appetites of human beings, and there is no question such laws represent an abuse of governmental power. The great libertarian Edmund Atwill Wasson commented in 1914 in a critique of the prohibition of alcohol in the United States that it was, quote, one thing to furnish the law and another to furnish the force needed to ensure obedience, unquote. Law is the instrument of popular will in democratic countries, and when a law is sufficiently unpopular, as was the law prohibiting alcohol manufacturing and sale for ludibund purposes in the United States, the people in theory will rise to overturn it. Would that it were so with unjust laws or unenforceable laws. When a government proves itself all too willing to attempt to furnish the force needed to ensure obedience to unenforceable and arguably unjust laws, then the very freedoms on which democratic rule is ostensibly founded are jeopardized. This is the case with the Civil War on drugs and the unprecedented intrusions into personal liberty which it inexorably occasions. It is a case where the cure is far worse than the disease, in which the proposed therapy is toxic and will prove fatal if administered in sufficiently high dosage. While the use of the drugs this shock therapy addresses continues unabated or indeed increases, freedom and dignity are on the ropes and in danger of going down for the count. I will adumbrate four lines of argument against the contemporary prohibition of drugs. Although disguised as public health laws, strictures against drugs are principally limitations on the pursuit of happiness and on the practice of religion in a broad sense, or in a sense broader still, are attempts to enshrine in law a certain perverse brand of what once was called natural philosophy. I call it science, and the overzealous modern laws against drugs are manifestly anti-scientific and indeed represent crimes against nature. A scientific perspective. Drug prohibition statutes are typically justified as public health laws, and conventional wisdom holds that in enacting and enforcing such measures, governments are exercising their paternalistic function of protecting the citizenry from dangers to public health, much as they would in framing and enforcing laws regarding sewage disposal, vaccinations, or pollution of air and water. Prohibition is thus seen as benign, indeed beneficent, and this viewpoint has become so firmly rooted in public consciousness as to make the concept accepted universally as a legitimate exercise, nay, as a solemn responsibility of capitalist and socialist governments alike. Nevertheless, viewed dispassionately and scientifically, this public health justification for prohibition won't hold water, and it can be argued rather that by placing certain drugs outside of the established quality control regimen for pharmaceuticals, governments are defaulting on their responsibility to protect public welfare. While some prospective drug users are dissuaded by laws, many, perhaps the majority, are not. During the prohibition of alcohol in the U.S. from 1920 to 1933, some alcohol users took the pledge and obeyed the law, whereas many, probably at least half, continued to use alcohol in spite of the law. Although it is impossible to establish firm numbers for present use of illicit drugs and the efficacy of the laws prohibiting them, there is no question that many millions of users, at least 20 to 40 million in the U.S., or about 10 to 20% of the adult population, are undeterred by the laws. During alcohol prohibition in the U.S., many inveterate users were poisoned by methanol and other solvents, poisonings which would not have occurred had legal controls of alcohol purity been in place. poisonings, which ceased to occur once Ludovan's use of alcohol and its sale for that purpose again became legal. Similarly, now there are some 3,500 premature deaths per year in the United States due to illicit drug use, many of them so-called overdose deaths from injected drugs, mainly opiates. Although these deaths are called heroin overdose, the great majority are rather due to adulterants and contaminants in illicit drugs, typical samples of which contain only a few percent of heroin or one or another artificial succedaneum, and illicit products may also contain dust, mites and other minuscule arthropods, spores, virus particles, and bacteria. On the other hand, medical injection, including self-administration, of sterile pharmaceutical opiates of known potency is a common, safe procedure, and deaths as a result of such use are virtually unknown. Injection of black market drugs has become a major vector of transmission of AIDS and hepatitis. Around 25% of all U.S. and European AIDS cases, including the majority of cases in heterosexuals, children, and infants, are a result of illicit intravenous drug administration. The barbarous practice of denying access to sterile syringes without a medical prescription prevails in the United States, whereas in most of the world's countries, sterile syringes are made available at low prices over the counter. This cruel and misguided measure is directly responsible for at least 25% of the new cases of AIDS in the U.S. and Europe. Far from protecting public health, prohibition is drastically expanding the AIDS epidemic and contributing to the deaths of thousands of individuals in the U.S. alone from drug overdose, individuals deprived of the protection of the Food and Drug Administration and its counterparts in other countries. This is especially important when we reflect that not all black market drugs are inebriants, not all drug users, hedonists, and thrill seekers. Owing to the restrictive nature of the U.S. pharmaceutical industry, there are black markets in curative drugs which have not been approved for sale by the FDA. Examples are the controversial cancer drug amygdalin or Laetril, dimethyl sulfoxide, a treatment for bruises and sprains. Users must employ industrial grade as no pharmaceutical grade is available. And the AIDS drugs azithromycin, AZT, and dextran sulfate. There are even black market drugs which fit neither in the category of inebriants nor chemotherapeutic agents. Biotechnology products are coming to be used illicitly by athletes. There exists a black market in human growth hormone and erythropoietin for athletes. The black market in athletic steroids has been estimated at $100 million annually and is growing. These steroids are being sold by mail and in health food stores. Other damage to public health is occasioned by drug prohibition. Some illicit drugs have valuable therapeutic properties and thus potential to alleviate human suffering. They are not being systematically researched and developed as pharmaceutical products, owing to the pall of disreputability cast over them by their legal misclassification. LSD was originally developed by Sandoz of Switzerland as a pharmaceutical agent under the trade name Delicid. While the novel medicine showed considerable promise in psychotherapy, one of the most exciting pharmaceutical prospects for the drug was as an analgesic and psychotherapeutic adjunct to agonist therapy, treatment of patients with painful terminal cancer or other fatal diseases. LSD and other entheogenic drugs proved to be valuable, long-lasting analgesic agents in some patients with severely painful terminal conditions, drugs which did not benumb and cloud consciousness in the manner that potent opiate analgesics do. The drugs also proved their worth in brief psychotherapy, aiding dying patients to cope with their situation. The propensity of entheogenic drugs like LSD to work against drug addiction led advocacy of their use to be termed an anti-drug position. Thanks to this demonstrated medicinal value, the Swiss government recently reclassified LSD as an experimental medicine, making it again available to physicians. Entheogens have also shown promise in treatment of alcoholism. Despite this plethora of therapeutic benefits of entheogenic drugs, their pharmaceutical development was cut short by their legal proscription and their illogical classification in Schedule 1, drugs with, quote, no currently accepted medical use, unquote, all but eliminated further research along these lines. Heroin, called deadly poison in the U.S., continues to be regarded as valuable medicine in other countries such as Great Britain. heroin or diamorphine is considered to be more effective and safer than morphine in treating the pain of myocardial infarction. Since both heroin and LSD have legal medicinal uses in other scientifically advanced countries, their U.S. legal designation as drugs with no currently accepted medical use is patently false and prejudicial. The illicit drug best known for its medicinal use is marijuana. This drug has shown many medicinal properties, but is best known as an anti-nausea agent for patients receiving cancer or AIDS chemotherapy, and as an appetite stimulant. Smoked marijuana and orally ingested tetrahydrocannabinol, THC or Marinol, one of the active principles, have proven to be valuable adjuncts to cancer and AIDS chemotherapy. Nevertheless, the U.S. government, to avoid giving mixed signals, recently stopped distribution of marijuana to new cancer and AIDS patients, although for the moment, Marinol will still be available. There is some evidence, however, that marijuana may be more effective for some patients, and it would be less expensive were cultivation for this purpose permitted. The U.S. government does, in any case, give mixed signals with regard to marijuana and THC. On one hand, the marijuana plant and its active principle are listed in Schedule 1 as having, quote, no currently accepted medical use, unquote. Then the same government shows the error of this misclassification by itself distributing marijuana and THC for medical use. These and other examples show that a decidedly negative result of prohibition of drugs has been curtailment of promising lines of clinical research and withholding potentially valuable medicaments from the public. Laws are thus working to the detriment of public health in contrast to their ostensible purpose. Meanwhile, the prescribed drugs are available to all comers, and users are deprived of the guarantees their taxes are paying FDA authorities and their foreign counterparts to provide. Yes, junkies and long-haired potheads pay taxes too, and enjoy the same rights to protection as nicotine fiends and short-haired gin freaks. Just as serious as keeping potentially valuable medicaments from the pharmacopoeia is the curtailment of basic scientific research consequent to prohibition. Bureaucratic difficulties with research involving illegal drugs and stigmatization of the field in the eyes of other scientists and personnel in governmental agencies caused basic research with controlled drugs virtually to disappear following their proscription. Scientists have been forced, for political reasons, to discard tools offering an approach to the classic brain-mind problem of philosophy, the biochemistry of consciousness itself. Nevertheless, such research will continue in countries with fewer regulations or a more enlightened drug policy. The U.S. Controlled Substances Analogs Act of 1986 has been perceived as illegalizing synthesis with the intention of studying their effects in human beings of any of the illicit substances or their automatically illegal congeners. It is illegal in the U.S. to synthesize and test completely novel compounds, the government in essence presuming to declare anything illegal unless specifically authorized. Talk about socialistic central planning and governmental control of industry. Pursuing this sort of draconian legal overregulation will ultimately doom the U.S. pharmaceutical industry to technological and economic inferiority as the next generation of mind drugs is developed elsewhere. Practical and legal considerations. The fundamental problem with drug control is that most human beings, in all eras and cultures about which we know, have used drugs to modify their mood or state of mind. In the U.S., there are nearly 200 million people over the age of 12, of which 178 million are caffeine users, 89%, 106 million are alcohol users, 53%, 57 million are nicotine users, 28%, along with approximately 12 million marijuana users, 6%, some 3 million cocaine users, 1.5%, 2 million heroin users, 1%, with about a million users, 0.5% each, of the entheogens and non-ethanol solvents, according to the government's conservative data from a household survey. Not only are numbers of illicit drug users greatly inferior to numbers of users of legal psychoactive drugs, but the scope of health problems associated with illicit versus licit drug use shows a similar disparity. Compared to the estimated 3,000 to 4,000 deaths per year as a consequence of all illicit drug use combined, which I might add includes people that were shot by the police and during arrests. Approximately 320,000 Americans die prematurely each year as a consequence of tobacco use, and they are accompanied to the graveyard by an additional 200,000 premature cadavers each year resulting from use of alcohol. Although there are approximately three times as many nicotine users in the United States as users of all illicit drugs combined, there are nearly 100 times as many deaths as a result. And although there are about five times as many alcohol users as illicit drug users, alcohol is responsible for some 50 times as many deaths. One might conclude that tobacco is some 30 times more dangerous than entheogens, marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, and that alcohol is about 10 times more dangerous. Or one might claim that in time we will discover that additional premature deaths are in fact due to illicit drug use. Nevertheless, the disparity is striking, and it cannot be argued that illicit drugs are justifiably illegal because they are dangerous, as long as substances evidently much more dangerous are legal. Many people persist in ignoring the fact that nicotine is an addictive drug, but former U.S. Surgeon General C.E. Koop stated plainly, quote, "The pharmacological and behavioral processes that determine tobacco addiction are similar to those that determine addiction to drugs such as heroin and cocaine. We should also give priority to the one addiction, tobacco addiction, that is killing more than 300,000 Americans each year." In the former Soviet Union in 1990, tobacco shortages sparked widespread riots, forcing emergency importation of American cigarettes. Long-suffering consumers would endure stoically chronic shortages of foods, clothing, and energy, but not tobacco. This, in the country in which the real czar once ordered the execution of tobacco smokers. Former National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, Director W. Pollan stated that tobacco addiction was, quote, "no different from heroin or cocaine," unquote. The severity of nicotine addiction has been underscored by the recent introduction of products to ameliorate the nicotine withdrawal syndrome, such as Nicoderm patches, transdermal nicotine bandages, and Nicorette gum, which became famous when former drug czar W.J. Bennett, who had given up a two-pack per day cigarette habit to set a good example, later admitted that he had relapsed and was still hooked on nicotine gum. Just say no and do otherwise. Not only is psychoactive drug use nearly universal among American adults, but virtually every culture that has been studied has been found to make use of one or another inebriant. Moreover, there is increasing evidence for the use of medicinal and inebriating plants by non-human animals, leading to the new specialty of zoopharmacognosy. Clearly, use of inebriants is a normal, ordinary activity, virtually universal among members of our species, and any attempts to prohibit one inebriant in favor of another, involving questions of taste, tradition, and prejudice, rather than scientific criteria, is destined for trouble. Laws will not deter many millions of people from using the drugs of their choice, but they can distort and pervert the legal system and wreak all sorts of havoc in the attempt. An avowed purpose of drug prohibition is to increase street prices of illicit drugs. The costs imposed on traffickers by the necessity of escaping detection and by the loss of occasional shipments or the arrests of personnel constitute a business tax which is passed on to the consumer. The expenditures on drug enforcement can be seen as a subsidy of illicit drug dealers. By driving up drug prices, laws enrich criminals and lead to theft and other crime to enable users to pay. Arbitrarily classifying millions of users as criminals and forcing users into contact with criminal elements sometimes associated with drug trafficking, drug laws then provoke more crime. Drugs, which would otherwise be cheap, become expensive in consequence of official policy, and theft and related crimes increase proportionately. Public health is again degraded as citizens are placed in greater danger of crime. Scientific developments, meanwhile, have compromised severely the forensic chemical basis for evidence in drug-related prosecutions. The discovery that the illicit entheogen DMT appears to be a mammalian neurotransmitter and that the drug normally occurs in human cerebrospinal fluid raises important legal questions. Diazepam or Valium has been found in rat brain and in trace amounts in wheat grains, and diazepam-like compounds have been found in bovine urine. Controlled opiates, morphine and codeine, have been found to be normal components of human cerebrospinal fluid, and morphine has been found to be a trace constituent of cow and human milk and to occur naturally in mammalian brain tissue. Trace amounts of morphine have been detected in various plants, such as hay and lettuce. Trace amounts of morphine in poppy seeds on baked goods can show up in the urine of the diner. With detection of morphine in urine considered prima facie evidence of heroin use in methadone clinic patients and in job applicants, and with drug laws flatly proclaiming that unauthorized possession or sale of, quote, any material, compound, mixture, or preparation which contains any quantity of, unquote, DMT, Valium, morphine, and many other drugs, where does this leave the concept of drug control and forensic chemical evidence? If morphine occurs in hay and lettuce, in poppy seed rolls, in every one of our bodies, even in mother's milk, on what scientific basis can an unauthorized cultivator of opium poppies be punished without also punishing lettuce and hay growers or proprietors and employees of supermarket chains and corner groceries for illicit trafficking in morphine present in every quart of wholesome milk? As citizens subjected to the absurd consequences of drug laws, we demand to know. On what basis? The absurdities and incongruities into which we fall in the looking glass world of the drug warriors by no means end there. A recent article proclaimed that the U.S. National Institute on Drug Abuse, quote, aims to fight drugs with drugs, unquote. That, quote, the agency is planning a massive search for medications to treat cocaine and other addictions, unquote, looking for, quote, magic bullets for addiction, unquote. The only magic bullets for addiction the authorities have found so far are the .38 caliber variety injected by police special revolvers. Let's treat whiskey addicts with gin while we're at it, or heroin addicts with methadone. Surely they can't be serious. Do they say this with tongue-in-cheek, or do they have something else in cheek? Perhaps a goodly quid of leaves from the stupid bush, which the CIA chemical warriors were searching for in the Caribbean in the 50s and seem to have found at home in Langley. Note that heroin was originally marketed as a cure for morphinism, and one of the magic bullets against addiction, bromocriptine or Parlodel, is already suspected to be an addicting drug. Of course, NIDA has no intention of treating whiskey addicts with gin, more like treating whiskey addicts with methanol, forcing people off one drug which they happen to like, and substituting another drug which will do everything for them but provide the pleasure they originally sought in drugs. This is treatment or assault. Meanwhile, as thousands are arrested for possession of cocaine, it has been found that a, quote, material, compound, mixture, or preparation which contains any quantity, unquote, of this controlled drug is the bulk of American paper money. In an analysis of 135 Federal Reserve notes of varying denominations and from different parts of the country, all but four, 97%, contain detectable quantities of cocaine. This means that virtually all Americans are in unauthorized possession of a Schedule II drug all the time. Or do you have a prescription for those banknotes? With the richest perhaps being in possession with intent to sell based on the gross weight of a big roll of cocaine-containing greenbacks, or ought we now call them whitebacks? Since the citizen carrying his Federal Reserve notes is legally just a bearer of a note which is the property of the Federal Reserve Bank, does this mean that it is the proverbial higher-ups who are to be arrested? Do I hear calls for an indictment against the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank and the Secretary of the Treasury for cocaine trafficking? Or since the buck ostensibly stops on the desk in the Oval Office, let's go right to the top of this sordid drug ring, to the President of the United States. Never mind the fact that the U.S. currency is printed on paper containing hemp, i.e. marijuana fiber, or that Betsy Ross's first American flag was sewn of hemp and cloth, or that the originals of the U.S. Constitution and Declaration of Independence are scribbled on hemp fiber parchment. Chemical technology has progressed to such a point that we are all in danger of being the enemy in the war on drugs, or prospective casualties. A military pilot, an officer in the U.S. Air Force, was court-martialed for illicit drug use when amphetamine residues were detected in his urine. Thanks to a little detective work, it was proved that an over-the-counter anorexic, diet pill, that he had been taking legally, a a product containing phenylpropanolamine as active agent, was contaminated in the manufacturing with trace amounts of amphetamine, as were other lots of similar products. The disgraced pilot was given back his commission and reinstated to active duty, but not restored to his prior flight crew status. A company called Psyche Medics is fighting the urinalysis lobby for a piece of the $200 million per year U.S. drug testing market, promoting a technology based on detection of infinitesimal residues of drugs or drug metabolites in hair samples. There is evidence that merely touching your hair after handling some of the Federal Reserve Chairman's cocaine-blighted bills could make you subject to a positive reading in a hair analysis drug test, or taking a stroll through the park and inadvertently passing through some marijuana smoke exhaled by some brazen lawbreaker. It has been shown that such passive exposure to cannabis smoke can lead to false positive readings for marijuana use in blood and urine tests, too. Drug tests involve the problem of false positives if detection thresholds are set low enough to detect all users. In urine, cannot tell whether morphine in the urine came from a shot of heroin or a few poppy seed rolls. Do you think the troops fighting the war on drugs are on your side? Can you be sure you won't one day be considered to be the enemy? Perhaps the skinheads are onto something. Let's face it, we're all on drugs, all of the time. I'm not talking about the industrial quantities of alcohol, caffeine, nicotine, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, etc., consumed regularly by humankind, but about the DMT and morphine our bodies make for us and which we consume all the time, or our very own sleeping pill, the endogenous ligand of the Valium receptor, which may be Valium itself, or the anxiety peptide which blocks that receptor, or our endorphins and enkephalins, which kill our pain, or substance P, our own pain-causing molecule, or anandamide, the endogenous ligand of the THC marijuana receptor. The life of the mind, of consciousness, is a constant, ever-changing pharmacological symphony, or to put it less romantically, a never-ending drug binge. The urge to ingest opiates or DMT or Valium is completely natural and as organic as can be. We are only supplementing or complementing endogenous drugs that make our brains work, and exogenous drugs are effective because they are identical to or chemically similar to our own endogenous drugs. Commonalities in drug abuse, irrespective of gross pharmacological differences between different classes of drugs, exist because on one level, all psychoactive drugs are the same. They are all fitting into our own brains, own receptors, for our own homemade endogenous drugs. Let us now examine the standards prevailing in a modern American drug violation prosecution. Entrapment of the defendant is the rule, and eyewitness testimony purchased from avowed criminals, whether outright with cash or with pardons or reduced sentences, is de rigueur. The luckless defendant may have been subjected to an illegal wiretap or search and seizure without warrant or probable cause, but since the police were acting in good faith, the police are always acting in good faith, aren't they? The evidence is admitted. More shocking and fraudulent is the established practice of regarding 1 gram of 10% heroin to be 1 gram of heroin in considering sentencing or the charge. Possession is distinguished from intent to sell, which carries much stiffer penalties by the quantity of the drug seized as evidence. This is especially absurd when LSD is seized. Doses may contain only 25 or 50 micrograms of the drug on a piece of paper or gelatin weighing tens or hundreds of milligrams. Imagine a farmer with a couple of tons of hay on the truck, hay which contains morphine in trace quantities. By this standard, she or he could be arrested for possession of a few tons of morphine. How about a raid on the pasteurization plant to bust the nefarious pushers of tons and tons of morphine, milk containing the drug, that is? My ludibrious tone masks genuine concern. As a citizen subject to entrapment and wiretapping, to all sorts of chicanery, prestidigitation, and fraud in the name of police work, I demand to know, we must know, on what basis can ill-starred individuals in possession of grams or kilograms of illicit drugs be prosecuted while ignoring traffickers in tons of Valium, morphine, codeine, DMT, or any number of other controlled drugs. On what basis? Entrapment, wiretaps, searches without warrant or probable cause, arbitrary enforcement due to the very ubiquity of controlled substances in our own bodies, on our money, in the milk we drink. These disreputable, slipshod, and unethical enforcement techniques threaten our freedoms and human rights. However bizarre or illegal a police tactic may be, once accepted in a court of law, then cited in another judgment, it becomes a precedent. And what once was a heavy-handed excess by rogue elements of police operating outside of the law slowly becomes standard practice acceptable in any courtroom. The use of emergency measures to deal with the epidemic of drug abuse and tolerated by judges who have swallowed anti-drug propaganda is changing the relationship of citizen to state to the detriment of individual liberty. Civil rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, the U.S. Constitution, the right to privacy, freedom from unauthorized search and seizure, the presumption of innocence, are steadily eroded and wear away.
And to us, we're having some technical difficulties. I'm going to switch machines and see if that repairs it. We're listening to Jonathan Ott in a presentation, actually reading from the beginning of his book, Pharmacotheon. And we'll return to Jonathan Ott as soon as I move machines. Ott, Pharmacotheon.
Civil rights, guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, the U.S. Constitution, the right to privacy, freedom from unauthorized search and seizure, the presumption of innocence, are steadily eroded and wear away, as surely as Thomas Jefferson's face disappears from an aging nickel coin, and police state tactics that began as wartime expedients justified by the deadly menace of drugs are suddenly being applied to all areas of law enforcement. Already we are seeing the same Gestapo-inspired police state tactics in the enforcement of other laws. Bizarre and illegal raids and seizures have been directed against so-called computer hackers, the police assiduously taking advantage of the legal dispensations given to the drug warriors. Can anyone be deluded into supposing that the U.S. government will draw the line at computer hacking as it flexes its new police muscle? Is it likely U.S. law enforcement officials will draw the line anywhere? The chief of Amsterdam's narcotics police commented that the war on drugs reminded him of the Gestapo, German police who, quote, thought they could change society's behavior. The police are a very dangerous element in society if they are not limited. We know what war means. We fight war against our enemies, not with our own citizens, unquote. The Netherlands has drug laws similar to American laws, but the government administers them in a fashion characterized as harm reduction or flexible enforcement. Narcotics chief Zal commented that illegal drug users are, quote, patients, and we can't help them by putting them in jail, unquote. In the wartime United States, then Los Angeles police chief Daryl Gates testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee that illicit drug users, quote, ought to be taken out and shot for treason, unquote. In the war on drugs, only the users are shooting the drugs. The police are shooting at us. People are the enemy. People become casualties. It is a dangerous game, and the black marketers are setting rules of engagement, an inevitable and predictable result of concentrating control efforts on the supply rather than the demand. The U.S. war on drugs is a supply-side endeavor. 71% of the funds in the fiscal year 1991 National Drug Control Strategy were destined for reduction of supply, 29% for interdiction and international control, and 42% for law enforcement. Only 29% for demand reduction. And I might add that to his discredit, Clinton continued those same priorities in his first budget for drug control, so-called. Since more than 75% of the 750,000 yearly arrests for drug violations in the U.S. are for simple possession, mainly of marijuana, It can be said that the U.S. law enforcement effort is directed at punishing users rather than reducing the supply. Interdiction and international control and toward interception of the drug at U.S. borders. The wholesale price of cocaine dropped 80% during the 1980s, while the purity of the drug as retailed increased fivefold, according to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration's figures. Since the DEA reported in 1987 that the foreign export price of cocaine represented only 4% of the retail price, there is no reason to expect a reversal in this utter failure to reduce supply. The drug is so cheap to produce and so lucrative that traffickers easily counteract any increased activity or expenditures by the authorities. Again, the laws constitute a subsidy to the traffickers, a value-added tax, and the money put into crop substitution in Peru constitutes a direct subsidy to increase planting of coca. Since interest rates are so high, farmers plant a small parcel in one of the accepted substitute crops as a cover, then use the bulk of the funds to plant more coca, the only plant sufficiently remunerative to enable them to repay the loans, except for opium poppies, that is. Heroin production is even more lucrative and even less influenced by enforcement activities. According to the DEA, the foreign export price of heroin is only a fraction of 1% of its U.S. retail price. As the international control efforts against heroin have been directed chiefly at the Golden Triangle area of Southeast Asia and Eastern Europe, traditional opium poppy growing regions, the traffickers have simply introduced opium and heroin production in areas not traditionally known for this. Opium poppy cultivation has become so widespread in Mexico that that country has become a leading heroin supplier to the U.S. Opium poppies have become the natural and preferred substitute crop for coca in South America, and heroin production is starting in Bolivia, Colombia, Peru, and Guatemala. The drug war has thus led the black market to its own crop substitution scheme, with the result that any reduction in the supply of cocaine will be more than compensated for by a substantial increase in the supply of heroin. This is progress. This is protecting public health. The U.S. authorities have been relatively more successful in reducing the smuggling of marijuana into the country, yet there is a plentiful supply of marijuana on the U.S. market. Not only is the drug cheap to produce, foreign export price 1% of U.S. retail price according to DEA figures, but the unintended, though entirely predictable results of the U.S. campaign against the drug have been the conversion of the U.S. into one of the world's leading producers of marijuana and the transformation of many former marijuana smugglers into cocaine and/or heroin smugglers. As costs of smuggling increase, smugglers will turn to loads with a higher value per unit of weight. Thus, exaggerated attention focused by the authorities on the smuggling of marijuana has led to vastly increased domestic production, obviating the necessity of sneaking the drug past beagle-eyed customs officials. The value of the U.S. marijuana crop in 1987 was estimated at 33